Recently, cyclist Lance Armstrong was stripped of his 7 Tour de France titles after illegal doping. So, will the Cancer Foundation Live Strong continue to live strong in Iowa? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we'll find out how organizations around Iowa who are partnered with Live Strong are doing and what they see in their future. Then, narcissism. What's envy got to do with it? New research at Iowa State University looks at how the relationship between narcissism and envy may provide some insight into sudden outbursts of aggressive behavior. That's all coming up this hour, right after a look at the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Recently, cyclist Lance Armstrong was stripped of his 7 Tour de France titles after an illegal doping scandal. So we wondered, will the Cancer Foundation Live Strong, which Lance Armstrong founded, continue to live strong in Iowa? Joining us to talk about that this first half hour. First of all, Marty Hoger is with us, a longtime supporter of the Live Strong Foundation, joining us by phone. Marty, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm going to talk about a couple of things. You're a member of Live Strong's RAGBRAI team, but your son Jack was diagnosed with a brain tumor 8 years ago when he was 5. I understand Jack is now 13. He has some seizures, but is currently cancer-free. How's he doing?
He's doing well, thank you. Where he's at today is he has a seizure disorder due to the radiation and the chemo that he was part of his treatment plan 8 years ago. And so he's more of a neurology patient now than he is an oncology patient.
Mm. Describe the past 7 or 8 years. It's hard to imagine, those of us especially who are parents, the roller coaster of emotions that your family must be on.
Well, when we were going through our treatment from the time we were diagnosed, or when Jack was diagnosed, to going through the treatment, the team of doctors in Rochester were very, very determined to let us know that this was no easy road, and in fact, Jack would probably suffer with a lot of side effects for the rest of his life mm-hmm. because of the extensive amount of treatment that he was going to receive. At that time, you know, you kind of say, do whatever it takes. We'll deal with the side effects later. Let's just have him survive this cancer. And so, to be honest with you, the last 6 years after his treatment, we just kind of take it day by day because these are kind of the things that we prayed that would happen was mm-hmm. the fact that the side effects are here, but you know what? We kind of asked for him because the alternative was that he would not be.
What is the hardest part of the day-to-day life? Obviously, when it becomes critical and you have to make a major decision, that's hard. But in day-to-day life, do you have points where you just have a very difficult time?
Well, you know, he is very delayed in school. He's 13. He's in sixth grade at Franklin Middle School here in Cedar Rapids. He's in a special class. Probably the hardest thing is just knowing where he was prior to having cancer, which was, you know, the normal 5-year-old boy going to alternative kindergarten and then getting ready for the kindergarten year, and just knowing, you know, how he was beforehand. And then he's right now, he is at the grade level of about a first grader or second grader. Mm-hmm. And so that's challenging. The other side of it is just the fact that physically he cannot do a lot of the things that normal kids his age or even, you know, just kids without the side effects can do. He was very active in t-ball and baseball. And so those are some of the things that he's unable to do it now. So, and he gets it. He understands that he can't do it. So it's frustrating at times.
Marty Hoger, you're a longtime supporter of the Live Strong Foundation. We want to focus on that this mm-hmm. half hour. How has the Live Strong Foundation helped you in your specific case, and now that we've heard a little bit about What's going on in your family?
Well, you know, when Jack was told, or when we were told Jack was in remission, one of the things that the doctors encouraged us to do is just not try to slide back into normal life, which is literally impossible after the cancer diagnosis. And she kind of encouraged us to be avid supporters of something in regards to bringing awareness to cancer, and in our term, pediatric cancer. And it wasn't until we found the Livestrong Foundation that we really understood what she was talking about, and that's the obligation of the cure. My wife and I, had sought out something to do because we felt like we were given this gift of our son surviving this terrible disease. And we went through a process that was not easy on us. It was not easy on Jack. He was misdiagnosed 3 times. Just trying to navigate our way through the medical field the way it is terrible. So we felt like if there's a way that we can help others, we wanted to be part of that. And so we started researching some things, American Cancer Society, which we're part of, just kind of trying to find how we could have a voice and how we can help. A good friend of mine sent me the book while we were in the hospital with Jack, It's Not About the Bike, which was written about Lance Armstrong. And about that same time, Lance was writing his 6th and 7th tour. And it really kind of resonated with us. We sent out a couple of emails to the foundation just to get more information about them. And we just really felt a connection with them. They're really based on the support of a grassroots effort, which we really enjoyed that part of it. And just the response, the response of the Livestrong Foundation, even to this day, 7 years later, if I send an email out to one of the staffs or even Doug Ullman, the president, it's literally 99% of the time it's less than 24 hours that I get a response from them.
You and your wife,
just amazes me.
Through RAGBRAI, you've raised a lot of money for Livestrong there, and you've met Lance Armstrong on a number of occasions, I understand. What was your reaction when Lance Armstrong admitted to using performance-enhancing drugs?
Well, to be honest with you, the reaction, of course, is at first is disappointment. Because, I, like myself, had heard all of the reports. I read several pages of the report that came out. But part of it was, just you wanted to believe that if he was tested so many times, there's just no way that he could not be guilty. I mean, he's got to be innocent because he was tested over 500 times, and how could he be different than any of the other writers that were tested guilty,
I guess there's two questions. Do you feel, let down, one by the doping, but also by the lying about the doping over so many years?
Well, here's, I guess the way I would look at it is my focus and our focus has never been on Lance. And yes, I've met him, half a dozen times. He's always been very gracious to us, always asking about Jack and my other 2 children. But I tell you, it's nothing where I felt like he cheated me, because I didn't know him that well for him to, you know what I mean? It's just, I didn't really took it. I looked at the work that the foundation does, and it's not the work that Lance does, because to me, they're 2 separate things.
Okay, Marty.
Yep.
Go ahead and finish up. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, Lance he was the founder of the foundation, and then he built a team that does a tremendous job in the cancer community. And that's what I think of Lance Armstrong. I don't think of Lance Armstrong and cancer being the one that, he cheated everybody and he did this just for himself and his fame. That doesn't resonate with me.
Marty Hoger, hang on there for a moment. Andy Miller is joining us as well, Executive Vice President of Operations for the Livestrong Foundation. Andy, welcome to our program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Marty Hoeger there. I want to get this national perspective. What has been the biggest struggle for Livestrong since Lance Armstrong admitted to illegal doping, this whole scandal?
Well, certainly, you know, the foundation exists to fight for people like Marty and Jack and anyone whose lives have been affected by cancer. So I think the biggest challenge for the foundation is that this has been a huge distraction for, you know, the 100 people we have here in Austin, Texas, as well as advocates, supporters, fundraisers that we have all over the globe, frankly, because it's not why they do what they do. They do what they do because, you know, they're affected by cancer. They have loved ones that are affected by cancer, and it's the work that we all are investing our time and energy in. And what's happening in the cycling world as it relates to our founder really has nothing to do with, you know, why we get up and do what we do every day. So for us, it's trying to stay about the business of helping people live with this terrible disease and provide them with the services and support they need.
Have you seen any declines in the use of your services? In what have you seen as a reaction to this admission?
Actually, that's been one of the few bright spots is that, you know, for the first time, I think some of this added attention has for the first time allowed people to truly understand what the foundation does and how we can help them in their own battle with cancer. So requests for our services have actually increased exponentially. And that's been very gratifying, is through all of this noise, people are continuing to understand that we are here to help them. And we certainly would like to engage them in how they can help support our mission. But we are really pleased to see so many people reaching out to us, sharing their story, letting us know how we can help them and allowing us to do that.
Mm-hmm. What about donations? You must have seen a dip there.
Actually, after much of this broke, we did see a surge of support from individuals.
A surge of support. No dip at any time.
Well, you know, nothing that we can't attribute to other factors. We're a member of the National Health Council, which is a number of the leading health-related nonprofits in the United States. And as an industry, we have seen declines in fundraising over the last year. And our decline is actually less than the average decline that most health nonprofits saw. So while we certainly did see about a 2.5% decline in 2012, that's nothing that we couldn't attribute to other factors, such as the economy or what other health-related nonprofits are seeing. So I think at the end of the day, we're left with a belief that we still have a very strong base of support, but we are obligated to continue to make the case for why people should support us based on how we can help them.
If you just joined us, we're dedicating this first half hour to talking about Livestrong. Recently, cyclist Lance Armstrong stripped of his 7 Tour de France titles after an illegal doping scandal. So we wondered, how does that affect the foundation's, the Livestrong Foundation's work in Iowa? Joining us, Andy Miller, Executive Vice President of Operations for the Livestrong Foundation. Before that, also with us, Marty Hoeger, a longtime supporter of the Livestrong Foundation, his son, a cancer survivor. Also joining us now, Dr. Richard Deming, a radiation oncologist at Mercy Cancer Center in Des Moines. Dr. Deming, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
In our Des Moines studio, we know from earlier conversations you're very involved with cancer survivorship, also through the Livestrong Foundation. Tell us, you work through the Mercy Cancer Center's YMCA's Healthy Living Center in Des Moines. What is this YMCA's connection to Livestrong?
So at the national level, the YMCA of America and Livestrong created a collaboration called Livestrong at the YMCA. And about 4 years ago, we became one of the members of the Livestrong at the YMCA family. And I direct a cancer survivorship program, and we headquarter that survivorship program out of the YMCA Healthy Living Center here in Clive. We've had over 600 survivors go through that program, and it's just one of the many programs that LiveStrong has been involved with, and it's been a tremendous success. It's been it's allowed us to sort of take the energy and philosophy and enthusiasm and empowerment that is at the basis of LiveStrong, and to really allow cancer survivors to use that energy to help improve their own fitness, their outlook on life, and to live a life that's more authentic and passionate.
Mm-hmm. You have said that the LiveStrong Foundation has done a lot for destigmatizing cancer. What is meant by that?
Yeah, I think that there's really no one in the world that has done more to destigmatize cancer than Lance Armstrong, and the organization LiveStrong has carried that on. So I'd describe it this way. I was born in the 50s, and if you talked about a cancer survivor, what is a cancer survivor? Back in the 40s and the 50s, to say you're a cancer survivor meant that a family member of yours died of cancer. That's what a cancer survivor was. Now, a cancer survivor is someone who's been diagnosed with cancer. In the United States, there are 14 million cancer survivors. Now, not every one of those cancer survivors is necessarily cured of cancer for life. And many of the cancer survivors have ongoing issues. And Marty articulated just beautifully the fact that, you know, Jack is alive, but Jack does have some ongoing issues. Many cancer survivors, even after being cured of cancer, face ongoing physical, psychosocial, and practical concerns. And LiveStrong's niche in the cancer survivorship community, and I'm a volunteer member of the American Cancer Society, Komen, Lymphoma, and Leukemia, they all do wonderful work. But LiveStrong's real niche has been empowering cancer survivors to get a team, to support them in their cancer journey, and then to also look out for all of the ongoing issues that may persist for cancer survivors after they've gone through their cancer journey. And LiveStrong is really at the forefront and works collaboratively with the National Cancer Institute, the American Cancer Society, the Center for Disease Control to actually lead the efforts in defining what are the essential elements necessary for cancer survivors.
Mm-hmm. Can you sum those up quickly?
Yes. So in terms of what are the essential elements,
yes,
it's important that cancer survivors have access to health care, ongoing surveillance to make sure that the cancer they were treated for doesn't recur, ongoing surveillance to ensure that other cancers they might be at high risk for, that those are being addressed. Also the psychosocial concerns, some of it being the anxiety of, you know, wondering what comes next, mm-hmm. and some of the practical concerns that have to do with fertility, with access to health insurance, and with ongoing access to health care.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Marty Hoger, if you feel that perhaps partially due to the LiveStrong's Foundation's work, that you feel that there is a decreasing stigma attached to cancer.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. To be honest with you, you know, prior to Jack's diagnosis, we didn't have other than, a certain family member, a great aunt that passed away with, you know, cancer or what have you. We haven't been involved in the cancer community prior to Jack. I will tell you, though, since, the support system that has come just, you know, out of the woodwork for Jack and mm-hmm. And it's been nationwide, and a lot of it has been because of the LiveStrong Foundation. We did a YouTube video back in 2007 for Jack, and it's been seen, you know, by 60-some thousand people on YouTube, not to mention the different forums that has asked to play it at their function. Not to say that cancer is a cool thing, but in our experience, it's been just that niche in the world that Jack has become a little minor celebrity in Sierra Rapids, Iowa, because he's the YouTube Jack, because he's the LiveStrong Jack, because of, you know, and it's not been that kid over there in the corner in the special education had cancer, so his hair didn't grow back.
Right.
Mm. You know, so it's a whole different level of what I feel the experience is today versus what it would have been 20 years ago.
Dr. Deming, tell us in the few minutes remaining, in addition to the YMCA's programs, you're also involved with a survivorship program Above and Beyond. That has a connection with the Live Strong Foundation?
Yeah, Above and Beyond Cancer does have its roots, if you will, in Live Strong. It never intended to be a standalone entity. Back in April of 2011, I took a group of 14 cancer survivors and 15 caregivers on a journey to Mount Everest Base Camp, and Live Strong supported us in that project and featured us in their quarterly magazine. And in many ways, the story there is a similar story to Live Strong. I like to describe that Live Strong sort of started with an extraordinary individual doing extraordinary things, and we're more about ordinary people doing extraordinary things. But the story is the same. It's about adversity leading to personal growth. It's about the courage and confidence that individuals get going through their cancer journey that allow them to do things they never would have dreamed, to reach above and beyond what they ever thought was possible. And out of that journey came the understanding that not only can the people on the journey benefit and have their lives transformed, but people who hear about the journey, people who follow the journey, that the journey can have this ripple effect and be able to help transform lives and inspire people to live more authentically and passionately. And ultimately, then, it's not just about cancer. It's about living your life fully, regardless of what the adversity is that taught you these lessons about life.
Andy Miller, we have about a minute left. From your perspective as Executive Vice President of Operations for the Live Strong Foundation, what's in the organization's future? What are you going to be doing in the future that you aren't doing now?
So we have some pretty ambitious plans. We are certainly fortunate to work with advocates and professionals like Marty and Dr. Deming, and through those partnerships, I think what we're hoping to really drive nationwide is this focus on patient-centered care. So for many years in the way we've addressed cancer, it's really been based on just the physical aspects of the disease, but we know we have such a great opportunity to really help to focus on the whole person and their family and make sure that not just the physical aspects of cancer are addressed, but also the psychosocial, the practical challenges, and how do we shape our healthcare system to respond to those issues.
Okay.
So working with groups like the American College of Surgeons, Commission on Cancer, to really drive some of their patient-centered standards, to work with cancer centers all over the country to implement these essential elements of survivorship that Dr. Deming talked about.
Andy Miller, we have to go. I'm sorry. Thank you for joining us this half hour. Executive Vice President of Operations for the Live Strong Foundation, Dr. Richard Deming, thank you for joining us from Des Moines. And Marty Hoger, thank you for joining us. All the best to you and especially your son, Jack.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, new research at Iowa State University looks at how the relationship between narcissism and envy may provide some insight into sudden outbursts of aggressive behavior. We can find out about that in just a moment. When we return, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Glad to have you with us on this edition of River to River over the noon hour from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour is all about narcissism. I was thinking if you could find one news soundbite from the past few years that sums up narcissism, narcissistic behavior, what would it be? Well, here's what came to mind for me. You may remember it back in the news back in 2009. Country music star Taylor Swift is accepting her award for Best Female Video, the MTV Awards. She's so thrilled, glowing under the spotlight with thunderous applause when up onto the stage bounds rapper Kanye West to interrupt her acceptance speech.
Yo, Taylor, I'm really happy for you. I'm going to let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time. One of the best videos of all time.
Well, narcissism itself has stepped into the spotlight of science news recently. Understanding the relationship between narcissism and envy may provide some insight into sudden outbursts of aggressive behavior. Narcissism has long been associated with envy in the field of psychology, but an Iowa State study now provides new evidence about that connection. Joining me to talk about it, the author of the study, Zlatan Krizon, is with us, assistant professor of psychology at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hello, Professor Krizon.
Hello. Good to be here.
Let's start with our foundation of making sure we understand what narcissism is and how it's different, say, from self-confidence.
That's an excellent question. It's also important to consider that when we speak about narcissism, we can speak about more extreme cases of what in the clinical area they call narcissistic personality disorder, and to distinguish that from a more sort of a normal range of expression of narcissism. So probably the most individuals we'll be talking about today are simply individuals who are relatively narcissistic without necessarily being disordered. So I just wanted to get that out of the way. As to your question about what is narcissism, there is a pretty much consensus that self-absorption, arrogance, and entitlement are key qualities of narcissism. So these are interrelated traits, that tend to co-occur in individuals we think of narcissistic. So this means that you believe you're special, that you deserve more than others, that others are really there to serve your own purposes.
Mm-hmm. And yet we define that differently than self-confidence. They seem to be together, but we teach our children to be self-confident. We want ourselves to be self-confident. What is the difference?
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that often comes up actually as an issue in this research as well as broader discussions. So self-confidence is important and is healthy. We need to be able to express our views, to assert our wishes in socially appropriate ways, to communicate with other people about things that are important to us. But when this goes so far as to, for example, ignore social norms, rules of appropriate behavior, then we start to speak about more narcissistic behavior. So it's really an excess of self-confidence or a disturbance in self-confidence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's really a continuum, what I hear you saying.
Absolutely.
A continuum, people who are very, very little narcissism and then more and more and more, and all of a sudden you get to a personality disorder. Your research defines two types of narcissism, I understand, grandiose and vulnerable. Tell us about those two.
Sure. And this is a distinction that has been made before, and as a matter of fact, it goes a long way back in this research area. I want to say that it's important to consider that these are not two distinct types. As a matter of fact, these are two sets of qualities that tend to co-occur in narcissistic individuals, such as that while a narcissistic individual may be high on both of these qualities, they could be high on one but not on the other. So if you think about the concept of size, you can be a tall individual and be large, and you can be a heavy individual and be large. And even though both are associated with the concept of size, neither one is completely necessary. So same here. So part of narcissism, this one aspect is grandiose. So this is being very exhibitionistic, wanting to be the center of attention, being extremely confident and extrovert in putting yourself outward to seek admiration. That's the grandiose aspect. And the vulnerable aspect is when your entitled expectations fail, and thus you feel that you've been really sabotaged by others, that they haven't recognized your greatness. And these are two different aspects that are somewhat present together in narcissism, but both are quite distinct and are related with quite distinct social consequences.
Mm. As you describe them, I can see that you could get into a grandiose phase, and then something happens to blow up that picture you have of yourself, and you slip into the vulnerable aspect.
Some clinicians, as a matter of fact, have interpreted that way, but it also seems that some people are sort of chronically either grandiose or vulnerable, depending mm-hmm. on their lives and what the social environment affords them.
Okay, we've laid the foundation there. You've explained it. Now tell us about your specific research that has been brought out that looked at the relationship between narcissism and envy.
Yeah, so this is a topic that actually goes, again, way back into theorizing about narcissism. And as a matter of fact, feelings of envy are one of the diagnostic criteria for narcissistic personality disorders. So for all those reasons, this is a topic that's quite important in this area. There have been a variety of ideas about whether and why narcissism should be associated with envy. And the prevailing idea is that those individuals who are especially grandiose, so who overvalue their abilities. So these are, again, components and aspects of narcissism related to grandiosity. The running idea has been that it's these grandiose individuals who should be very prone to envy, given that they really sort of feel this grandiosity will be threatened, or really the notion that they don't buy into their own sense of worth. That's been the prevailing view, and what we have shown across a series of studies that involve both surveys of students and community residents, as well as laboratory behavioral measurement, what we've shown is that really the vulnerability, that it's extremely, extremely potent predictor of envy, and that people who are grandiose perhaps even envy less, which in some way makes sense, because if you really buy into your own fantasy of being great, there's not going to be many other people to envy out there.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any public figures in mind that you could name where you could say they are definitely in this class of grandiose narcissism that is not fueled by envy?
I will always be reticent when giving these names, and as well as make clear that we're not talking about disordered individuals, but from my observations in terms of the kind of personality qualities that we associated with these personality constructs, I would have to say Donald Trump is probably a good example of a definitely grandiose person that intends to engage in a lot of haughty behavior, express a lot of self-confidence. And I think if you look at his speeches and his public comments, I think many a time he refers to definitely not being the person that envies others, but the one that's being envied by
others. And you certainly see he has marketed his outbursts of aggression.
Absolutely. And sometimes with these public figures, that actually becomes an issue, because it's not clear to what extent you're really sort of observing personality qualities as they are of an individual versus some kind of a public persona they're using in order either to mm-hmm. to earn money or to drum up attention.
Even when we have an example like Donald Trump as perhaps a good personality of that that we can point to mm-hmm. as a public personality, mm-hmm. we could still say, I mean, you can't diagnose from afar. Mm-hmm. This may still fall short of what the definition of narcissistic personality disorder is.
Absolutely.
Where is the line then when you get into the disorder?
That's a great question. And I think in general we draw a line when certain aspects of personality really start to interfere with social and occupational functioning, right? So when you have an individual whose entitled expectations and whose haughty treatment and arrogance toward others really gets them into a spot where they have trouble with their intimate relationships, with their work, with their circle of friends, perhaps leading them to be extremely distressed or angry or perhaps even depressed, it's in those extreme cases that we can speak about disorder. So it's always that interference aspect that it's key to something being a pathology.
So similar to alcoholism.
Absolutely.
Where so, you would say yeah. if you can, I mean, there are functioning alcoholics, mm-hmm. but if you say it gets in the way of your day, your life, your relationships, then you have a problem.
Yeah, and the same, I think, criteria can be used for a lot of addiction concepts that are being discussed, such as video game addiction. It's not just enough to play a lot of video games. The point is that you play so much as that really becomes a detriment to other aspects of your life.
In your research, your latest research, what myth are you breaking?
Well, this myth that if you are very grandiose and full of yourself, that down beneath you actually envy others a lot. And in our research, we seem to refute that pretty consistently across a lot of different forms of evidence. So, mm-hmm. It seems that really the grandiose individuals really buy into their own fantasy. And it's these vulnerable aspects of narcissism. So individuals who still have these grandiose fantasies, they want to be great. yet they really sort of can get over the hump, and thus they view all these other people as superior and as sort of potential threats, and tend to envy them a lot and feel a lot of hostility and resentment toward these other people because, in a sense, they don't allow them to be great as they want to be.
Mm-hmm. We were talking with my producer beforehand, Sarah Bowden, about this, and we were thinking, you know, narcissism as a personality disorder is unique in that we make a lot of jokes about narcissism. We have shows like The Office. The boss, Michael, in The Office is a classic narcissist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've seen that show, but I wonder if your studies, your research is harder or different in the way you have to approach it or the way you talk with people, because it is not recognized in the same way as schizophrenia or depression in a personality. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and this is a general, I think, issue with personality disorder, and there is very vigorous debates currently going on in psychological and psychiatric communities about how personality disorder should be conceptualized. And the view that I subscribe to, that indeed seems to be suggested by most of empirical research, again, is the one of the continuum that you described, mm-hmm. such as that when we speak about personality disorder, this is not really a qualitatively different category. We're speaking about individuals who have extreme standings of certain combinations of traits that tend to create a lot of either interpersonal difficulties or emotional difficulties or both for these individuals. And it's in that realm when you start to speak about personality disorders. So in some way, the classic kind of disease models that have been applied even to psychological disorders really don't fit very easily in this realm.
How do we treat narcissistic personality disorder?
This is a challenge with all personality disorder because by definition, they are sort of grounded in individuals' personalities. So they will be resistant to change. They probably reflect enduring dynamics about these individuals. So usually the treatment is slow and difficult. And traditionally, it's oriented around self-insight and helping these individuals realize that either overly grandiose views of themselves or these overly vulnerable views of themselves are not very accurate, and as well as trying to help them to establish more intimate, more functional relationships in their lives.
So if I understand you correctly, it's holding up a mirror to their personality and making them pointing out things in that mirror that they weren't aware of before?
Absolutely, and especially within a context of their functioning and relationships. So, again, and the modern approaches are pretty diverse and involve some of the traditional ideas as well as advancement that's been going on in cognitive behavioral therapy, etc. But it's definitely, in heavy cases which need treatment, which are sort of extreme cases by definition, the treatment is usually recognized as difficult. To give you a sort of acute story that illustrates some of these difficulties, there's one account of a person in New York City who was seeking treatment for narcissism. And this person identified the most well-known, well-regarded psychiatrist in a city. And when he went and visited with the psychiatrist's office and learned that he can be treated there, he decided not to seek treatment anymore. Because, by golly, if he cannot be treated by the most famous psychiatrist in New York City, he's not going to be treated by anybody. So these are some of the issues, for example, that clinicians report in dealing with these individuals.
So in this kind of work, can you give me an example of a dialogue that you might have or a therapist might have with a narcissist?
So because I'm not a clinician and I don't do therapy, so most of my research does not involve protracted discussions with individuals. It's rather assessing their personality qualities and personality traits and then assessing other variables, for example, such as envy toward their peers or aggressive responses in laboratory paradigms of aggression. And usually, we'll administer a variety of questionnaires, such as that the purpose is necessarily not going to be obvious. We don't ask people if they are narcissistic or view themselves as narcissists. We rather ask them a lot of questions about their personalities, about their tendencies to behave, act, think and feel in particular ways, and from that, based on sort of knowledge we have from prior studies and this validated questionnaire, we can extract information about where they stand on this continuum regarding narcissistic grandiosity and vulnerability.
Are there a handful of questions that our listeners can ask themselves to find out if they have a narcissist in their life?
There are definitely those questions. As a matter of fact, there are a lot of sort of popular books that try to teach you, you know, whether you're living with a narcissist and what you should do if you are. I think, again, to what extent the individual that you're interacting with behaves according to ways to either buttress their self-view, to protect their sense of self-esteem, the way they express themselves, anger or surprise by not being treated very positively or admired by others, by viewing themselves being sabotaged by others, not recognizing their value and worth. So in general, those are the kinds of things one needs to look for. But again, the specific presentation could quite vary. And I just want to add one more thing too.
Sure.
That makes this difficult is when we think about this grandiosity of vulnerability, the life circumstances can put a really different spin on this disturbance. So some people have, for example, invoked the concept of acquired social narcissism, meaning that if you're in a life position where you are of high status, you're very well off, you are very well admired, you do have capabilities and abilities. So in a sense, there are reasons for you to be valued and admired by others. You know, over time, you can develop this sort of cult of personality and a sense of yourself as somebody says more important to others. I mean, think about some of these actors and stars who are constantly surrounded by yes men and by people catering to them and complimenting them, and you know, they can do no wrong. I mean, after living in such an environment, especially if you have some of these narcissistic tendencies, you may develop a lot of narcissistic qualities, but they may not have a lot of interference to the extent, for example, you're rich, you have a lot of money, and you can basically accomplish the thing that you want to without a lot of interference from others.
Mm-hmm. Talk more about what you think creates narcissism, more of the upbringing, or are we born with this quality?
This is a million-dollar question always, and historically the answers are focused on parent-child interactions, for example, having cold and indifferent parents. There's not a lot of empirical research on this for a lot of reasons. One of them is that, you know, ideally we'd want long-term longitudinal studies where we follow people from childhood all the way into adulthood, and those are very rare and expensive. But I think we need to consider narcissism in a context of broader personality differences as well as the social environments that people function in. And so we know that certain aspects of personality are key to these grandiose and vulnerable expressions of narcissism. So being very ebullient and extroverted and dominant is key to grandiosity. And we know that this extroversion and dominance is a heritable trait. We know this is something that's partially reflected in temperament, even in newborns. So I think there are these more broader aspects underlying narcissism, which are certainly genetic, partially inherited, and shaped by early infant interactions. But I think we still don't have a good understanding of that sort of magic step or those very important events that may be happening in early childhood or young adolescence, which seem to create this differences in narcissism that can already be seen in high school age kids.
We have about a minute left. I wonder if you could give us a forecast of where you're going in your research with narcissism.
So in ongoing research, we're really focusing on this link between narcissism and aggression, and this is something that comes up very often in public discussion, especially recently with the cases of Christopher Dorner, the police officer in L.A. And in this work, too, we are seeing as the narcissistic vulnerability almost being a bigger problem for aggression. And again, these are not individuals that we may notice at the outset as being narcissistic or consider narcissistic, because they're not likely to be very exhibitionistic. They're maybe festering there in the corner wondering why other people are not recognizing their greatness. And when that push comes to shove, they seem to react aggressively. And indeed, this seems to be a theme that at least on the surface fits a lot of these events that we've been seeing recently.
Mm-hmm. And so specifically, how will you attack those questions?
So what we do...
We only have 30 seconds, sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. So we do, for example, laboratory experiments in which we involve people in particular behaviors which they think serve one purpose and in reality serve to assess aggression. So in this way, we can sort of get more pure a sense of their aggression without them getting in the way of their own natural behavior.
Okay, Zlatan Krizon, thank you very much. Assistant Professor of Psychology at Iowa State University.
Thank you.
You for coming to our studio today.
You too. Have a good day.
Okay, you too. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden and Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. We had help in Ames from Jason Burns today. Podcasting and on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Politics Wednesday tomorrow. Hope you'll tune in. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.